Mr. Cutlets, Mr. Cutlets, when you swing around that pork chop, I get a whiff of heaven every time you pass my doorstop. With the chicken and the brisket and the marrow and the giblets, Mr. Cutlets, spend some time with me. I know it's crazy, but it's true. It's not worth eating if it lacks the greasy. Cutlets, Mr. Cutlets, when you burst into the kitchen, you grab a fist of meatballs.
Hi, I'm Josh Ozersky, and I'm Mr. Cutlets. I'm here at the Heritage Radio Network at Roberta's wonderful Calzone House in Bushwick, New York, and I'm here with Eddie Schoenfeld, a.k.a. Eddie Glasses. What's up, Eddie?
Hey, did you know calzone rhymes with baloney?
Almost.
You know, you said you're not high, but I still am not 100% convinced.
It's my normal demeanor.
Now, Eddie, before we go on talking about your trip to Spain with El Chad or the vicissitudes of taquitos or whatever the hell it was that I was going to talk about, I think we should say something about our sponsor, Fairway. Fairway Market is, in my opinion, has the best retail meat that you can get. No disrespect to the Lobels, but it's half the price and as good or better.
Well, you know, they do have a terrific meat department. I, as you know, live in Brooklyn, not far from Ozerkistan, and I cook every day, and I market almost every day, and I can be seen prowling the aisles at Fairway. Indeed, I was there today. In fact, I'm making a little birthday party for a friend tonight, and don't have much time to cook, and I'm making some porterhouse steaks, and I ran over to Fairway to buy them because it's terrific, and so many other things are available in that store that it's really changed marketing in Brooklyn.
Oh, there's nothing else like it. It's changed the way I live, really, with the way their olive oils have greased my path forward in life. But I want to go back to parenthetically. You said you're making a porterhouse steak.
Two of them, actually, yeah.
Now, I got to tell you, people like to make the porterhouse because it's the best of both worlds. It's got the strip loin on one side and the filet mignon on the other side.
And maybe a little piece of chewy tail, but very tasty.
Right.
And, it has great gristle.
Well, that's what I was going to bring up. A lot of we old-time meatheads prefer the T-bone steak to the porterhouse steak. Now,
The short loin, and so is a porterhouse.
Eddie, I mean, since I'm running the show here, and I'm the host.
You're Mr. Meat.
I'm Mr. Meat. I don't go talking about egg foo young, come on. Anyway, by the way, this is a call-in show. You can call in right now at 718-497-2128. And ask Eddie, who is a great expert on Chinese food, and me, who is a shitty expert on meat, any question you want. T-bone steaks are along the short loin, down the backbone from the porterhouse. It's got a littler section of the fillet.
It has a smaller fillet and a more gristle-free piece of sirloin.
The reason for that is that there's a large nerve that runs along the edge of the shell, and that nerve is in the porterhouse, but generally not in the T-bone. It gets bigger as it moves along, but it's those last three steaks, and you have to, when you cut the strip part, if you cut that strip out and you cut it into pieces to make little dominoes, as people sometimes do, because now, like, I imagine you're going to serve your steak sliced up into pieces Peter Luger style, right?
Very possible. So the only reason to do that, to do that nicely, you'd want your steak to rest for a solid 10 minutes.
Which they never do at Peter Luger.
Let the juices go back in the meat. Right. And the reason you do that is so each guest at the table can get a little part of each part of the steak.
That's right, and the ladies can have the tenderloin, the men can have the strip.
You know, as I have gone through life loving those steaks, I've developed a little more of a taste for the filet.
Have you really?
Yeah. I mean, it really, when it's cooked on the bone from a prime carcass, it's aged meat, you know, it's good. It's delicious. And I appreciate the difference in texture. Texture, being a Chinese food person, texture is extremely important to me. As if you really get into understanding Chinese food, one of the really prime aspects of it is that Chinese chefs are always seeking great texture in their dishes. And they often will choose texture over flavor. Or they'll say that I don't need the natural flavor. I can put a sauce on it to give it very good flavor. So I appreciate the variety of texture in a porterhouse steak.
That is one of the things I don't like about Chinese food. Yeah, there's like, oh, if I want flavor, I'll put a sauce on it. What the hell? What kind of... I mean, there's just a lot of things about Chinese food that I don't... That's one of them. I don't like how they cut the meat all up into little pieces so it all looks the same.
Well, you know, I don't think I'm going to convince you right now, but, I mean, part of the philosophy of using a wok and of stir-frying is first you set the textures of the food, the meat and the vegetables, and then you move to flavor it. And that's a very, very... fundamental part of the cooking philosophy in a stir-fried dish in a wok from a fine Chinese cook's perspective.
I appreciate that, and I grant that a lot of the very fine Chinese cooking does have an absolute mastery of texture. Certainly in previous appearances and when you've talked to me in the past, you've talked about the so-called velveting
right,
of,
that's
of
a way
fish
to,
pieces.
That's a way of cooking pieces of protein right. extremely equally.
However, I'll give up a little mastery of texture. I mean, to just take those meats, like when you have those meats that are in various sauces, the flavor doesn't come from the meat at all. You can't tell if it's pork or chicken or
well, that's
or
precisely
lamb or anything
what
else.
I was saying to you, that really the flavor is coming from the sauce, not so much from the fundamental ingredient.
Well, that seems to me to be fundamentally against the natural law of cooking, which is that things are supposed to taste like themselves. Otherwise, that's like 19th century shipboat cooking, you know?
Well, you know, I think we could have a long show talking about this because I tend to view things a little differently. I very often will see a recipe and I appreciate it when something is in its natural state and you can taste its natural flavor. And I often look for that, especially as I've been around the food world for a long time and seen a lot of very ornate and Baroque cookery. Sometimes something just simple on a plate with its own natural flavor brought out is the best thing of all, you know, like a perfect
piece
of fruit.
But that's exactly what I'm saying.
I understand, but in Chinese food, the philosophy is really a little bit different than that. They're looking, when they have a shrimp, they want shrimp flavor, but before that, they want the shrimp to have a crunchy texture in your mouth, or they want a piece of
so
beef to have a velvety texture.
Great.
And they will choose that texture if it's a choice between the natural flavor. For instance, when we make a stir fry, let's say, of a beef, one of the things that happens with beef is if it's cooked rare. Once it sits for a couple of minutes, juices come out of it.
Right.
So Chinese chef, when he's thinking about that, is saying, well, I'm setting the texture of this meat, and then I'm putting a sauce on it. And rather than putting a big, thick gravy, or, you know, we would complain about a lot of sauce that's too thick with cornstarch or something, we'll do something where we have just enough flavoring on the food so that each piece of food has taste, but there's not liquid on the plate. We call that gan sao, or dry cooked food. And one of the things that's an enemy of that is after you sauce certain vegetables and meats is and you thicken the gravy to be in or the flavoring to be just the right viscosity, it'll sit on the plate for a couple of moments and then the liquid will start coming out of the vegetables or start coming out of the meat and diluting the sauce. And
diluting the sauce with what it's supposed to be.
Well, to a good Chinese chef, though, they don't think it's supposed to be diluted
like
that.
It's so interesting.
They just want it to be the food to be coated, and they'll cook the vegetables in a meat in such a way so that they won't have liquid exuding out of them.
All right. Well, Eddie, I want to hear about that, and I want to take issue with your assertion about Chinese cookery, although certainly I like bad Chinese cookery. but let's take a break and come back in a couple of minutes on the Mr. Cutlets Show. Ooh, and it's all right, and it's coming home. Hi, I'm Josh Ozersky, and I'm here at the Mr. Cutlets Show, which is our radio program at Roberta's incredible sweetbread fortress in Bushwick, New York. This is the Heritage Radio Network coming at you from Pirate Satellite at Roberta's, care of the Fairway Market, whose meat we love and whose olive oil, particularly the Novello, which is what I've been drinking now practically from the bottle. I forget what the end of that sentence was supposed to be, particularly the Novello, say. Now, I'm here with Eddie Schoenfeld, a.k.a. Eddie Glasses. Hello, Eddie.
Hi, Josh.
And Eddie and I were talking about Chinese food, but you may have questions about Chinese food or meat or media or any of the things that we know about. And if so, you should call 718-497-2128, most Ricky Tick, and we will answer your question. Now, Eddie, you're talking about Chinese cooking and why it's not supposed to, food isn't supposed to taste like itself. And I...
Well, I didn't say it's not supposed to taste
like
itself.
Well, that it's supposed to taste like its sauce.
That they prioritize the textures of things over their natural flavors, feeling that they can put a sauce on top of the food once it's the right texture.
Now, have they discovered any new... Like, do they know about sous vide and the modern CVAPs, the various techniques that French chefs now use? I mean, or are they still stuck in the 19th century?
I have not seen... Well, I they're just stuck in a different place. But, you know, Chinese chefs are not cooking sous vide food that I've seen, unless they happen to be trained in French cooking.
The Vietnamese, a lot of them are, like, oh, as a matter of fact, I was going to say, because Vietnamese are French too.
You know, I've seen Michael Bao.
Michael Bao, he makes that delicious pork belly.
Right.
Bar Bao.
Right. You know, there are Chinese chefs who are getting more exposed to Western cooking, you know. I just came from Bilbao and San Sebastian in the Basque region of Spain on a culinary trip there. And there were 9 of us on the trip. And one of the people who was on our trip was Joe Eng, who is the great dim sum chef and who is the chef at Chinatown Brasserie. And, you know, Joe and I are going to be opening a restaurant in the springtime called Red Farm. And it was a chance to expose Joe to the new molecular cooking. We got to go to Arzak, you know, who's, I guess, the grandfather of the molecular food movement. And it was, you know, very exciting, I think, for Joe to see, the different kinds of techniques and tools that are being used now and really fundamentally changing the face of what we know of as fine food.
But what's an example of something that Joe does, like... Because I like Joe a lot. I think the meal, I'll tell you out there that I have eaten Joe's food for the new restaurant. He made a tasting of some of the dishes, and it is so sick. It's far and away the best Chinese food I ever ate. I've eaten a lot of the high-end Chinese, and it never knocks me out. What's something that Joe does that's, in terms of technique, like in the kind of food that I ate at that tasting, that is a departure from this old school?
Well, you know, I think it's his culinary techniques are not so much changed as they are refined, and he's able to express his own take on things and his own personality because his technique is so strong. So you'll see Joe doing things which are amusing, where he'll make something, and, you know, he'll make a porcupine shaped dumpling, really very creatively taking traditional ingredients and using pieces of almond maybe to make the outside of the dumpling, you know, look like it has an armor on
it. Well, but who cares?
And
about
he's
that,
using,
though,
I mean, you know, actually one of the flavors you said is overused. You know, he's using yuzu in his cooking, which...
Right, nachamol with the yuzu.
Well, you know, except when in the hands of a really terrific chef.
No, that's true.
You know, yuzu is a wonderful ingredient.
Oh,
it's
like
a citrus. And so he was doing a wonderful... of all the things that he made at tastings that I was at, my favorite thing was a simple batter dip fried shrimp.
You know what?
With
I was just
going
to say that shrimp, I remember that shrimp.
Yeah.
That shrimp was amazing. Well, the shrimp is a good example. If you think about Joe's food, those shrimps didn't taste like some kind of focaccia black bean sauce or whatever. It tasted like shrimps. And Joe's best dumplings, from a technical point of view, and I only know this from because you're my guru in on these matters, but you can certainly see that those little vegetable dumplings he does, like with the chives or whatever, that are so fresh and delicate, and you can
clean tasting,
and you can see through. It's like you can see through the dough. The dough is so delicate.
Yeah, and but you know, it's a really interesting thing. I cook a lot of mushrooms, for instance. And in Western cookery, we'll take mushrooms. We'll let's say we'll dry them. We'll have porcini. We'll soak them. We'll make sure we harness the flavor of the mushrooms by taking that soaking liquid and incorporating it in their cooking, in their sauce, having them reabsorb it, concentrate it. Joe might make a mushroom dumpling by taking mushrooms and blanching them in water.
That doesn't make any sense at all.
I know. But he ends up with terrific results because he's getting a certain kind of cleanness, and he's doing it very quickly, and then he's reflavoring them with just the right amount of salt and just the right amount of complementary other vegetables, maybe a little brunoise of celery or carrot or bok choy. And the combination that he's coming together with is very clean and fresh and natural
now,
tasting.
Is that a new kind of Chinese food? Now, that's not what the last emperor ate.
You know, it's not so much a new kind of Chinese food as one chef who has developed a really, really high level of technique, and it's him taking that technique and playing with it and learning
That's
from it.
Right. So he's kind of like the Michael White of Chinaman.
You know, this is what a really top chef, I think, throughout my career, when I've seen really great chefs, the best ones get to a point where they're really able to express their personality through their food.
Right. And without leaving the tradition.
Right. Exactly. They stay within the tradition. They may even expand the lines of the tradition.
Right.
But they are able to take something of them, the inside of themselves, and put it into their food. And that's, you know, why I'm so fond of Joe and his food, because he has a certain combination of cleanness and of very, very high level technique that's really special. And he just brings it all together in one package. We're doing some dumplings, for instance, in a kind of a quick service setting. One of the projects we're working on is a place called Red Farm Stand. It's going to be opening in the new food park project that we're working on. It's going to be a series of food stalls. And Joe had a very simple solution for a quick service dumpling thing. He made some really great dumplings from shumai, traditional shape, but made with chicken and shrimp. And he took them and put them, four of them, on a skewer and pan-seared one side of them. Like a pot sticker. But when you get handed this item, you're getting a little skewer with four dumplings on it. And you can hold it in your hand and bite one off.
Right.
And it has a little crust on one side. It's just sensible. It's good cooking. And nothing great, you know, new about using a skewer.
No, but that counts for a lot. You know, we have to take a break, but I say here, kudos to Joe, because edibility is something chefs don't think about enough, even good ones. You know, I mean, it's not just a question of preposterously overloaded lobster rolls and chili dogs, or, you know, dishes that have got seven items that can't all possibly fit on a fork at the same time. But I mean, like, to get the thing so you can eat it, that's part of it, and getting it all in your mouth in the right order.
And to make it appealing and attractive and easy to handle, and to get you to take a couple of bites.
Yeah.
You know, suddenly it's in your hand, you finish it,
to go to this food park. This is, by the way, Eddie is doing this with Jeffrey Chodorow, who I consider, I mean, I'm friends with the guy, admittedly, so it's like, you know, write me off. But I think he is underrated as who's willing to roll the dice on a lot of concepts, some of them are not that great, but I mean, some of them are going to be fantastic, and some of them are really good now. This one is going to be freaking sick. I can tell you the Joe Ng part of it is, you know, forget about it. And have anyone talked about the other, is that out yet? The other various concepts that are going to be in?
You know, we haven't spoken about it publicly, but I'd be happy to, you know, reveal something on your show. I mean,
all right, let's do that after the break.
Okay.
And I'll remind people that the number here is 718-497-2128. And this is the Mr. Cutlets Show.
Can you still remember how it seemed? We could live forever in a lover's dream. And falling was the best part, but now you know the things you cling to your heart can start to grow. You're walking away. I've been there, now I know what to say. I'm the king of yesterday. A silly little love song for myself. It's all.
Hi, I'm Josh Ozersky, and welcome back to the Mr. Cutlet Show. Thank you. No. It's quite all right. Really. That's actually what I hear in my head at all times. That was Jude's King of Yesterday. They say sometimes they say that he's a Elliott Smith ripoff artist or whatever, but I think he's better than that. Now, Eddie, I'm here with Eddie Glasses, by the way, at the Heritage Radio Network at Roberta's Pizza and Pork Chop Castle. And Eddie, we
tonight were, aged sirloin steaks too.
Yeah, tonight the special is aged sirloin. They're doing the cavatelli with the oxtail ragu, but I don't think that one works as well. I wish he would bring back his spaghetti alla Grecia. Anyway, that's neither here nor there. Eddie was about to do the big reveal, which is tell us about some of the other people that are going to be in Food Park.
Well, first of all, Food Park is what I don't think you've told people what Food Park is.
What is Food Park?
Food Park is a new market that it's only a market after of a sort. It's a series of food stalls that are going to be opening at 6th Avenue and 30th Street at the end of the summer. Right now, the official opening day is September 1st. And we're going to have a series of very focused small food stalls. Some of which have seats at the stall, some of which don't. And some of the stalls are going to be outside in a new park that's being created that's running between 29th and 30th Street. And I was telling you that Joe Eng, the great dumpling chef, and I are opening a little restaurant down on Hudson Street in the springtime this year called Red Farm. And then in September, we're going to be opening a small branch of Red Farm. It's going to be known as Red Farm Stand. And it's going to be built inside Food Park. And in addition to Red Farm Stand, one of the other concepts that's going to be there is something called the Bacon Company.
Really?
And that is going to be a small place.
Who is that? Who's going to do that?
We're doing that ourselves.
Oh, you're doing it. But Bacon, what do you mean? Who's doing you?
Well,
and who?
I'm doing
you and
it.
You and Ilchad or you
I'm,
and Joe?
You know, I'm the consultant on this project. So it's my job to imagine and set up the different stands. And some of the stands we may have outside chefs coming in.
You know, Eddie, if you need someone to tell you about bacon, suggest great bacons.
Maybe
I'm
be
considered
the
to be one of the foremost authorities on bacon.
I heard you were very, very thoroughly smoked, yeah. but cured, I doubt.
Smoked out and
I
not
doubt
cured.
You've been
yeah,
cured,
no,
yeah.
That's true.
But
fatty, too.
So we're doing a little stand that was kind of meant to be a hamburger stand originally. And I came up with the idea of converting it to a kind of a stand that specializes in
bacon,
eggs, and burgers.
Bacon, eggs, and burgers. Well, if you don't ask me about the hamburger program, I think you've got to have your head
So let's ask you about bacon. I mean, what's your favorite bacon beyond Benton's?
Well, all right, but... I'll tell you this, but will you tell what the other stands are going to be? Like, for example, isn't Michael White doing a pasta thing there?
Well, it's possible that Michael White is going to be doing a baked pasta stand with us. We've spoken about that, but honestly, we haven't made
any final arrangements. Who are some of the other people that you're talking to?
You know, we haven't been speaking.
We're not speaking about it? Okay.
No. Right. Actually, you're misunderstanding. We're not really using very many outside people at all.
Oh, that's not what I heard.
Well, you know. You hear different things from different folks. One of the
at different times.
There's going to be
for different reasons.
There's going to be a chocolate pudding stand.
Oh, a chocolate pudding stand! Really?
That's right.
You know that's my favorite. My favorite dessert.
I
love chocolate pudding.
I think that you know that I know that.
Yeah, I know. Yeah, remember my girlfriend? You taught my girlfriend how to make it. and try to perv her in the process too.
But that's
all right.
Well, you know,
I understand.
She recognizes a good chocolate pudding when she sees one.
She's foxy.
She's getting married to a chocolate pudding.
I know. I know. We're getting married on May 23rd. All right,
so,
Eddie. To answer
so
your,
how was that chocolate pudding?
That was like the second or third best chocolate pudding I've ever eaten.
What was the first best?
Well,
Cozy Shack.
I gotta say that. Okay. Well, Lee and Riyadh's. You asked me a question. Is it okay?
Sure.
Can I answer you? Is that all right if I answer you?
Maybe.
I had the poke cram at Balthazar and Mineta Tavern that Lee and Riyadh do. That's one of the all time greats as a pudding. And then.
Is it really a pudding?
Well, isn't poke cram pudding? It's the same thing to me.
Yeah, show me the recipe, I'll tell you.
So is mousse. I had Sebastian Zepp's mousse at Bar Blanc Bistro the other day. That was freaking sick. The one Dan Silverman does over at the other place there, the Standard Grill, that's a great pudding. But I'd say yours is either the second, maybe the second best pudding I've ever had.
So,
maybe the first, Eddie.
You know, so what we're saying is that there are a bunch of really good ones, or a group of, not a bunch, but a group. And this recipe is a really terrific recipe.
All right.
You know,
well,
so
whether
it's a 95 or a 97 out of 100,
just
I don't
tell
know.
Me that it'll be cold and then you can get whipped cream on it.
You're going to be able to get cold A-plus recipe chocolate
all
pudding
right.
there.
Because nobody, I'm telling you right now, first of all, you know my thing, like nobody likes hot chocolate cake. Nobody wants that. Nobody wants that. Nobody likes it and nobody wants it. And hot pudding is the same thing. Hot pudding is like a platonic love affair or something. No one wants that. Now, Eddie.
Well, this is traditional. Let me ask you one more question
okay.
now.
But you didn't.
How do you feel about skin on your pudding?
That I can live without. That doesn't come on Cozy Shack, so I don't like it. That's my frame of reference for pudding.
Okay.
But Eddie, you asked me about bacon.
Yeah, like what I've been researching bacon. I'm just at the beginning.
Don't ask me. I mean, that's all right.
I know you've had a bunch of baking tastings. Yeah.
You know, I get sick of my own self-importance. It's
right. Did you say self-importance?
Yeah. No, but I see it's the thrashings of a vain and insecure man. But
so
to answer your question,
yeah.
The bacons that I most admire in America are not necessarily those of Alan Benton. Benton's is exquisitely useful for cooking because of its unstinting smokiness and saltiness, but it's unbalanced, and eating it straight up can be a little rough. I like Gatton Farms in Missouri. I think that's a great bacon, particularly the Dan Phillips blend. The guy calls himself Captain Bacon. Founded the Bacon of the Month Club. I think that the bacon that's produced by, there's a place called, I'm pretty sure it's called Mountain View Farm. There's a guy named John Ubaldi. He's up in, he's upstate in New York. That's the only good New York bacon. The best bacon I think I've had in America, and nobody gets it. You may want to listen to me instead of playing with your iPhone there.
I'm taking notes.
Oh, really? Are you really? You're taking notes on... Really? You know what? That makes me feel just great. Okay, well, here's what you should write down. Summerfield Farm. This is a place in Virginia that only sells bacon in 4-pound slabs. And it's, to me, is pretty much the best bacon that I ever had. I mean, you know, I like a lot of different bacons. I don't like the green market bacons here in New York. They all suck.
Let me ask you a question. What, taking aside, you know, who makes the best bacon... Have you seen some interesting uses of bacon? What have been the most fun uses? For instance, I've been talking about pastrami flavored bacon.
Ugh.
And I've been thinking of a Mexican braised bacon
that my friend
Maricel Precia makes.
Well, Eddie, you know, unfortunately, we're almost out of time. But Jack, can I take an extra minute to answer this question? Because I think it's interesting. Bacon is I'm sure you agree with me about this. Bacon is a grossly overused component in cooking in New York at the moment because, you know, it adds cheap thrills to almost any dish, including the most unenjoyable and innocuous of like Brussels sprouts or whatever.
Well, the euphemistic everything goes better with
everything
bacon.
Goes better with bacon.
Right.
But they'll throw it in with mushrooms or whatever. First of all, everything that I see that's made, all things that are made with like lamb pancetta or pork pancetta, whatever, like those, all the various carbonaras are all better with bacon. I'll tell you who does a great thing. I don't know if he did bacon or not. He did guanciale, which is the closest thing to bacon. Not close, but no cigar, but it's
a little cheeky.
Here at Roberta's, Carlo does a spaghetti alla Grecia, which basically is you take the little pieces of guanciale and you pour you cook up little pieces of bacon and you pour it and the bacon grease into the spaghetti and a little pasta water. You emulsify the grease and the pasta water together. Maybe if you were like me, you might want to add a little Novello olive oil, or if you want like the fairway, the real nutty, the one that I love, the Umbrian one. Anyway, you emulsify it together so it makes like a sauce with
that bacon.
So
lardy mayo.
Because that, unlike your Chinese friends that want to put different flavors into things, that tastes like bacon. And it's more like the disgusting bacon explosion that everyone was talking about. That's
big sausage meat wrapped.
Yeah, a big nasty mess. This is like you really are getting the essence of bacon, and you're getting bacon and the essence of bacon. And it's like a carbonara, but there's no egg to screw things up.
And you're talking about a product that's not a smoked product, right?
Well, no, it's a cured product, but bacon is smoked, of course.
Well, our bacon, but when you talk about guanciale,
right.
I think you're just talking about
cured
pork.
Right, and so imagine it's that much better. If you do the griglia, spaghetti alla griglia, or I gave the recipe in my Rachel Ray column on rachelray.com for, a spaghetti due grazie with the two fats. Anyway, that's my answer.
Well, we're doing a little place called the Bacon Company,
it's gonna be
a little lunch, breakfast and lunch counter.
Okay,
and there's gonna be bacon in many of the things. Actually, there are two parts to the menu.
All right, Eddie,
and no bacon.
All right, well, I'll stick to the bacon part, but unfortunately, and I'm very sad about this, we're all about done. Eddie, you can write. Eddie, do you want to give your email address if people have questions they want to ask you about your adventures
or
Chinese food?
Sure, ed@eatingwitheddie.com.
And, of course, I can be found on time.com, where my column comes out every Monday. Also on rachelray.com, where I write a cooking column. And via my book, The Hamburger History or whatever.
And walking the streets of Uzbekistan.
Walking the streets of Uzbekistan. Anyway. It's Eddie Schoenfeld. I'm Josh Ozersky. We're here on the Heritage Radio Network on the Mr. Cutlets Show.
Mr. Cutlets, Mr. Cutlets, when you swing around that pork chop, I get a whiff of heaven every time.